Welcome once again to Word on the Hills, with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Jim Christie. Each week, we visit with an author from our region. We get an introduction to their work, sometimes a glimpse into their lives. We try and find out what prompts them to write, and give them an opportunity to read from their work. We're very pleased to have Jim with us today. Jim Christie has been described as a literary vagabond with few peers. George Woodcock called him one of the last unpurged North American anarchistic romantics. One of his publishers has called him a hip Indiana Jones. In 1972, reviewing his first book, June Colwood said he was one of the best writers in Canada. However, he's also one of the least known, according to Books in Canada magazine, which suggested two reasons for this curious situation. The first is that Christie's many interests defeat attempts at categorization. The second being that those same interests don't leave time for him to be a literary careerist. Jim has written books on many, many topics, from boxing to eccentric homes and gardens. He has traveled and written about many troubled spots in the world, among them Soweto, Nicaragua, El Salvador. As an adventurer and traveler, he discovered a lost Mayan city of gold. A gardener, a sculptor, and a spoken word performer with a jazz blues ensemble, a novelist and a poet, Jim has also been seen in film and television productions, usually in non-speaking roles as a thug or a gangster. In fact, Jim has done so many things and written so many books that it's going to be difficult to even touch on them all in one program. Let's start chronologically, Jim. You were born and raised in the States and wrote about this in Street Hearts, an autobiographical novel. So can you tell us a little about your early life and how you used it in the novel and some of your later work?
Well, that novel is actually straight autobiography. Mm-hmm. There's no fiction in it. But the publisher said, well, no one knows who you are. No one's ever heard of you. So, you know, no one's going to buy it if we call it an autobiography. And would you mind if we called it a novel? I said, not at all. And that is what it's known as. But it's a portrait of life. One reviewer called it an environment that was on the cusp of old world traditions. It was an Italian neighborhood in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And things hadn't changed, hadn't modernized yet. So you were still living in a different era. 2 years ago, I went to Naples, and it was just like being in my old neighborhood. The parts hadn't changed in Naples. So they were like Philadelphia. It was like my area of Philadelphia in the 50s.
Yes.
So, and you had Italian food, you had all the, everything you'd find over there. Gangsters, boxers.
Yes. A wide experience of life you had there then.
I didn't know it at the time, but I guess it was.
So when you first came to Canada in 1968, you lived in Toronto and co-founded two underground publications, published your first book, The New Refugees, American Voices in Canada, then moved on to essays, biography, a book of poetry, Palatine Cat, before you wrote your first travel book, Rough Road to the North. I don't know how you did it all. Tell us a little about that period of your life and why you moved out to British Columbia in the early 80s. Did your writing change when you moved to Gibson's?
I don't think so. I think if you're a serious writer, you're going to write what you have to write. It doesn't matter where it is. And as a matter of fact, it might help not to be where your book is set, unless you're writing nonfiction. I wrote the book about the Alaska Highways, published by Doubleday, called Rough Road to the North. And I didn't write that up in the Yukon or Alaska. I wrote it somewhere else. But yeah. I'd been up there so many times that I knew it and felt comfortable that I didn't have to go around and pause at different spots along the road and write it. That was fun. The U.S. Corps of Army Engineers basically built the road. One of those groups of people up there in that Corps of Engineers were black people, most of them from the American South. And I met an old native guy in 92 when I went up to cover the 50th anniversary of the completion of the road for Equinox magazine. And I was talking to him about had been around during those days. And he said to me, yeah, You know, the first white person I ever met was black.
Oh, that's a lovely story. But still, when you went out west, you did write 4 detective novels about Jean Castle.
Yeah, well, there's always an exception to that and everything I say. Yeah, I did. I set them in an era before mine.
Right. I was going to ask you, why did you choose that setting?
Because I wanted to invent a Vancouver that is exactly the way I wanted it.
Uh-huh.
I let my imagination run free. I didn't do much research.
Uh-huh.
I just said, this is what it looked like in 37 or 39 or 41. And nobody seems to know the difference.
People were convinced.
Well, they didn't know the difference. Maybe it means they didn't have that many readers.
I don't know. He sounds like a fascinating character to me.
Yeah.
He may be a tough guy, but he's sensitive to the beauty of the city, which, of course, came out of your mind, you're telling me. But still, I love this quotation. There was fog and sunshine at the same time, and all but the very tops of the tallest buildings appeared to glow from within like illuminated cotton candy. And he seems to have had a romantic streak, for he goes on, hell, what the old burg really looks like is a hophead's Kublai Khan. I just love the way he admired the city, so goddamn beautiful that, like any self-respecting hophead, I don't want to come down. And I wanted to ask you how important you think an atmospheric setting is to a mystery novel.
Well, to these novels, it is very much important because Vancouver is a character in the book, really.
Mm-hmm.
If you were setting it in some prairie town, well, that too. Yeah. But some places have more atmosphere than others.
Well, the writer's good enough.
He could see the beauty through the clouds.
Right.
On the occasional moment when they part and the little sun comes through. He was cherish those moments.
Well, we'd love to hear you read from that book, so please do.
How about if I pick up from, I think the last word you said was cotton candy?
Yeah, that's fine. Go from there.
Those tallest buildings poked through this spun candy land and glittered in the rare and magnificent sunshine. The jagged spire of the press building shone brilliantly. It could blind a fella or a gal, and the red W atop the Woodward's pile might be bloody prophetic. Sure, this is the kind of day that comes around these parts once in a blue moon. But don't get carried away and enjoy it too much, because that W doesn't stand for wonderful, nor Woolworths neither. Woe is what it really means. Well, thought Castle from the deck of the Santa Lucia out of Lisbon at the foot of Shanghai Alley, here I am just back in town, and already my mind is going funny. Of course, there's a perfectly legitimate way of seeing these things if one is the Old Testament type. But your straight line logic or your academician's version of the truth ain't in it, which is what I've learned over there in the Orient, Indochina to be precise, these last few months. Hell, what the old burg really looks like is a hophead's Kublai Khan. So goddamn beautiful that, like any self-respecting hophead, him or her, I don't want to come down. But they're waiting on me, calling, come down, Castle. Come down to these, your tawdry streets. And then he is off the boat, and his lady friend is not there. And it starts the plot going.
Thank you very much, Jim. That was great.
Okay.
Now we'll take a short break.